mindfulness mode.
You're not relative to anybody else.
Hey, Mindful Tribe, welcome back to another episode. And today we're going to be talking about a couple of things. And one of them is that my guest is the co-founder of a healthcare startup. We're going to be talking about that. But he went on to write a book that I am really looking forward to talking about. It's called The Road to Maresco. So we'll talk about this historical fiction novel that he's written. And I'm really, really looking forward to talking with Mark Jamielkowski. So Mark, are you in mindfulness mode today?
It's towards the middle of the afternoon on a work day, and I am trying my hardest.
Me too.
You know?
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing, actually. I know this is something that you focus on a lot professionally, as well as, you know, entertaining your guests with this podcast. And by the way, I greatly appreciate you having me on this today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
But it is mindfulness. For me, it manifests itself in connection. You can go through a whole bunch of exercises and try to align yourself to be in the moment, which is what a lot of mindfulness literature tries to get you to focus on. But there's a missing piece I find in a lot of that literature. And that missing piece is, in some cases, it's vulnerability. It's being able to open up to another person. In some cases, it's awareness, being able to open up to yourself, to really understand what it is you're feeling. So in the spirit of, are you in a mindful mood now? Let's get there together.
Oh, that's a great idea. A perfect suggestion. Well, I am interested in your book. I'm interested in that Road to Maresco historical fiction novel, but I was going to say, what does mindfulness mean to you? But I don't need to say that because you basically told me.
Yeah, you know, it's something I've worked on a lot, actually. I'm older, I'm in my upper 50s, and I went through a lot of my life just, you know, nose down, shoulder to the grindstone, got my career objectives, life objectives, family, all that, and very much focused on the doing, getting through that. And it's really only been last, I don't know, maybe 10 years. You know what? Let's be honest. I was learning 10 years ago, and I think I've been actually practicing in last 3 or 4 years. So relatively new to this game.
Yeah.
And for me, yeah, I've had this long career over 3 decades in healthcare, and I've done all this stuff. And yet at this point, I find that the things that I can find most rewarding are the moments when I practice something I call my sacred time.
Okay.
And the reason I call it sacred is, in my own mind, I've created this acronym, basically, that stands for what I try to achieve in that moment. It could be 20 minutes, right? It 5 minutes, or it could be an hour and a half. Depends on what my schedule allows, right?
Mm-hmm.
Stillness of mind is the S.
Uh-huh.
I try to be aware of myself, my surroundings, even if it's, you know, how much light is coming through the curtains in the room, right?
Just, yeah.
That's the A. The C stands for connecting. This is, I mentioned that the idea of what's going on inside? Can I still my mind? Can I listen to my heart? Can I listen to my mind? What am I feeling? Stress, anxiety? Am I emotional about something? Is something upsetting me? Am I carrying it forward? You know, am I trying to get rid of it? Am I trying to feel something? Like, for example, I find myself in my job, I get crazy busy.
Right.
And I shut down. You know, I close off, right? So one of the things that I try to work on when I have this time is my connection is to open up, you know, and to undo that shell, right?
Yeah.
And then if I can do that, then I can relax.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think of like a bowl of water, and if all of my anxiety and stress and all of the stuff that's going on in my day is like banging a hammer on the side of that bowl of water, then the water is all disturbed and bouncing all over the place, right? So I got to stop that hammer. so that the water can be nice and clean. How many times have you heard that analogy, right? Oh, you can't achieve anything until you can see yourself in the still waters, right? Still the water.
And was that your life? Like a lot of the time you were really stressed out and not very focused?
I think that's normal. I think that's kind of what we train ourselves for, right? My parents were, children of the Great Depression and World War II kind of thing coming out. So their childhood was infected by that. They carried that forward and laid that on me in terms of, get a good job, establish yourself, be financially secure, be concerned about all these things that can go wrong. And that's what you're focused on, that kind of drive, right? And that kind of puts you into this mindset of go, go, go. And it's, a lot of these things you start thinking about, well, how do you relax when you're just on this constant go mode, right?
Yeah.
I have an appreciation now that it is probably the hardest life lesson for anybody to know that what they're doing today, in the grand scheme of things, doesn't matter.
Right.
No matter who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's the next thing that's going to come, and 1,000 years from now, there'll be some better technology. There'll be some new thing. Something's always going to evolve. It's in motion. Life is in motion, and we're just part of it for a given point in time. But in as much as we are, in essence, doing nothing and mean nothing, we're also critically important because nothing would get done if we don't do it.
Right.
So we're both. And I think that is a hard lesson for people to really lay into and understand and kind of grasp and make part of like their DNA.
Yeah, I think it's a very hard lesson. Right. And you said that you've only really been involved in all of this kind of mindfulness stuff for mostly like 4 or 5 years.
I would say in a truly purposeful, conscious kind of way. Yeah.
So before that, did you feel like your life was just going by at a hectic pace and you weren't really sure what was happening?
I think that there was a lot of frustration and resentment and rage and those types of emotions, negative emotions that were really building up inside me that were impacting me, which forced me to suddenly say one day, wait a second, something's not quite right. I need to take a different path with this and reevaluate like how I'm processing things.
And what was the first step of that new path? What was the first thing you did when you decided to forge a new path?
There was a catalyst, right? There was a catalyst. I live in New York City and I was walking down the street and, lots of people, busy, standard stuff, nothing unusual, wasn't personal, but this guy walked in front of me, cut me off in the middle of the sidewalk, coming across the street, cut me off, almost knocked me over. And I wanted to take him down.
Yeah.
And I knew that that impulse was so strong, was so vibrant in that moment that something was wrong.
Did you say something or do something at that moment?
I knew what I wanted to do.
Yeah, but and you didn't yell or anything.
I didn't say anything or do anything, but I knew what I wanted to do.
And what did you want to do specifically?
I was violent.
Punch him.
Oh, more than that.
More than that.
That's why, because it was so extreme, it was such an extreme reaction and just how coiled up I had become that I knew I needed to seek some help.
Wow.
Which was really interesting because I found, my parents, nobody in my family really espoused or talked about or encouraged any level of introspection or therapy or anything along those lines. So there was no assistance to be had in that regard.
Right.
Right.
But you were in your 50s by this time, or close to it, right?
Yeah.
Late 40s?
Late 40s, yeah. I walked in and I just happened to have found a therapist that got me from day one, right? And the funny thing was, when I sat down in her office and she said, how are you? And I said, fine, because, what else am I going to say?
I'm in
defense mode, right? Right.
Yeah.
And she said, well, that's a load of crap. You want to start over again and start telling me the truth?
Yeah.
I was like, wow. So that was kind of a trip, and she was something. She helped me out a lot, and I've moved on from there, and you know, I've kind of taken the ball and run with it myself. And there's just you know, we talk about mindfulness, I think, unfortunately, has become a bit of a cliche.
It has.
A little bit overused. And I think that when I think about what I try to achieve for myself, right, the sense of peace,
mm-hmm.
right, I think about it in terms of balance. And part of being balanced for myself necessarily requires me to let go of other things, whether it is negative emotions or weights or stress or anxiety. I have this other analogy. I'm kind of a visual person at heart, you know, even though I'm very technically oriented and a math guy fundamentally and professionally. But I think of it like a large, we stand on a disc,
mm-hmm.
and that disc is balanced on a ball.
Oh.
So we're constantly having to shift our weight in one direction or another,
mm-hmm.
in order to maintain the balance.
Right.
And if you, the way I think about it is, there's an Apache. I'm a student by nature. I love research. I get into this stuff, which is why the book came out. But the Apache or Navajo debate. You know, we can get in, you know, have to get some other people on who are more experts in this, but indigenous peoples had a medicine wheel. And the four main quadrants, you know, north, south, east, west kind of idea on this medicine wheel were emotional well-being, spiritual well-being, intellectual well-being, and physical well-being. So if you think about those four points on this disc that we stand on, at any given point in time, as we move through life, we're carrying more emotional weight than anything else, then that tips our disc in that direction and we have to balance back out. And if we're not getting enough exercise, then that part of our disc is light and other parts of the disc are heavy. So we, you know, it's, and I, using that as a mental image,
mm-hmm.
it kind of reminds me that in order to maintain this balance, in order to be able to achieve any level of sense of joy or fulfillment, in order to be able to get into that mind space, I have to be willing to let go of the things that are creating the imbalance on my disc, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And if I do that, that makes me more aware and I can relax.
Mm-hmm.
And I begin to connect, and now I suddenly find myself, you can call it mindfulness, you can call it Zen, you can call it peaceful, but there's this balanced sense of non-judgment, no labels, no ego, just sort of an existence that has an element of fulfillment and gratitude towards it that I strive for. Not always successful at it. First one to admit that. It's always a work in progress.
Yeah.
But this is kind of how I think about it and how I process it.
That's cool. Well, what does the R stand for?
It's sacred is stillness of mind, right? The A is the awareness of yourself and your surroundings. C is the connecting, you know, feeling that yourself, the energy around you. R is relaxing, letting go. That's the letting go aspect.
And that's letting go is a huge part of it, isn't it?
It you can't get to the next part
without
the energy. E is energy.
Yeah.
Right. I would tell you that I do yoga every day. Every morning I do yoga. I'm terrible. I at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, if I haven't done my yoga in the morning, my coworkers know it.
Oh, do they?
They can tell.
Yeah. And what's the D?
D is being devoted to the effort.
Ah. So essentially to keep doing it, to keep focused on it, right?
Yeah. And the E is the energy, feeling the energy.
Right.
You know, and I've had yoga teachers and you know, I've been in and been in these seminars or mm-hmm. you know, you listen to the YouTube pod things and you know people talk about, oh, you know, you connect with the universal energy and be the part of the one, and
mm-hmm.
you know, that's great if you can go sit in an ashram someplace in the Himalayan mountains and you don't have to pay bills and mm-hmm. there's not like you know, food to have to put on the table and dinner has to be made and the dishes right. have to be washed and you know, the dog wants to be taken out and yeah, the noise of life is around the noise of life is around you, right?
Yeah.
The kids are screaming, you know, he touched me. All right. it's great. I get that. That's fantastic. But the reality is maybe you can achieve moments like this if you're lucky every now and then, right? And I've had maybe one or two over the course of the last 4 years or such that I felt like I could feel like I was intuitive to other people, to, you know, the energy that they were giving off in such a way that I could tell as they're walking towards me that, let's say, they were anxious or they were having a lot of, there was something on their mind or they were nervous about something or, you know, that kind of stuff. You could just pick, but like I said, like maybe once or twice or, you know, in the last 4 years. So it's not something that you can just carry with you and say, oh yeah, I've got my energy card right here.
Yeah.
I've earned my badge. doesn't work that way. It's a constant effort, which is why the D, you have to be constant and diligent. Yeah. Diligent would be another good D word for it. Being diligent about it, you know, just continuously working at it and know that it's something that you'll never perfect. It's always something that you're going to have to work on. And it's just one of those things. Yeah.
So Mark, did you go to the road to Marasco? Did you go to Italy and walk on that road?
I did not. See, the road, the title of the book has kind of three separate meanings.
Oh.
And on purpose. Mm-hmm. The book is actually meant to be read almost three times.
Oh, is it?
Because the first time you're going to read it to kind of understand the lay of the land, let's say looking to identify the forest.
Mm-hmm.
The second time you're going to read it, you're going to get more into the trees, you know, and understand the details of it. The third time you read it is to be more of the experience of being in the forest with the trees kind of idea.
Well, it's about a mother and her daughter, but the people are real. Even though it's a fictional book,
yes,
it's real. So is it your mother and is it your daughter?
See, there's a twist. I can't give too much away here.
You can't tell us.
I can't. Suffice to say that Marasco is a town in Italy. It's real.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And towns in Italy tend to be named after the people who established the primary source of employment. You know, you think about it like feudal times, there would be the development of enough industry for one person's estate that they would have, you know, 7,000-10,000 people working for them in various ways. Suddenly that's the town, right? So they would name it after them. Marasco's no different, same idea. So walking the road to Marasco, getting to Marasco, is also referring to Maria Luisa Marasco, who is the primary character that we follow starting from the early 1900s.
Mm-hmm.
As she is born here, she is identified as being a piano prodigy. She goes to Venice to study. She's going to Rome to play in the Teatro de Romeo. She, you know, she's well connected. Her family's very wealthy. They're putting her in front of the best teachers in the world to develop her skills. This is all prior to the rise of Italian nationalism, Mussolini, and that time period.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as that happens, the shift in Italian culture is such that women being interested in any level of career outside of the home were dissuaded from doing so. They wanted the women at home, in the kitchen, raising families, knitting, darn, you know, and being good wives.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, and being protected. That was kind of, you know, protect the homeland, protect the motherland, protect our mothers. You know, you're not allowed to go, but you, by the same token, we don't want you to put yourself at risk and actually go out and pursue your own dreams. We want you to do what we want you to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she finds herself pregnant.
Okay.
But her fiance, paramour, boyfriend, whatever you want to call it, he is swept up in Mussolini's drive to establish Italy as being a power in the European theater. He is sent over to Spain during the Spanish Civil War and is killed.
Oh.
So she is left with a child that she has to raise on her own. Part of the story here evolves at this point from telling the tale of a woman and the evolution of her as a single mother and her striving to become a pianist to one also about the resilience of the human spirit and being able to overcome constant onslaught of trials and tribulations that life throws at you.
So the idea
is I got to meet her daughter. Her daughter's name is Kiara. When she immigrated to the United States, they mislabeled her name. They translated it from the Italian, Chiara, into something English, Americanized, as Clara.
Okay.
So I got to meet Clara as an old woman.
Okay.
And as Clara and I started having conversations, I learned more about her life. I realized that Clara and I had actually crossed paths or almost crossed paths many times before. She lived in New Haven on Howard Avenue. My father used to take me to play baseball while my mother was getting her hair done around the corner on Church Street in New Haven while we were visiting my grandmother who lived in West Haven. And we would go to the back of the fire station to drop a quarter in the machine and get the green bottle of Coke we were done throwing baseball, right?
Yeah.
This was literally around the corner from where Clara lived.
That's really fascinating.
Literally around the corner. So in just getting to know more about her and her life and everything that she went through and how she even came to live in the United States, having been born in Italy and grew up in Germany with her mother and during World War II and her experiences. And I have to be honest, I didn't believe her.
Mm.
She would tell me these stories and I'd be like, that's a little crazy. That's out there, Clara. I'm not sure I can really, I mean, I, you know, you're a sweet little old lady, but I think you're lying.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I started getting these books and looking things up on the internet and finding new sources. And whenever I read, I take notes. And as I started taking more notes, I realized I basically had an outline.
Okay.
And I'm trying to describe her life. And I said, well, okay, fine. Yeah, you met your husband in Stuttgart at the army base. Well, how the hell did you get to Stuttgart? I mean, you told me you got born in here, and then you suddenly, you know, 16 years later, you're in Stuttgart. But how did that happen? And you start asking questions and unraveling a little bit about her mother's life. And you start getting a few points, little tidbits. Start stringing together some of the points of the tidbits, and you start to develop the story. At the end of the day, the road to Moresco then is the story of Maria Luisa Moresco and her daughter, Chiara, as it starts in the early 1900s all the way up through 2021. So there is a strong element of truth. Their lives form the bedrock of what is the landmarks, if you will, as this journey takes place. So there's the saga of this family's ordeal and how it came to be, and the three kids that Clara ultimately had and raised, and so on. The road to Moresco is also the road towards self-discovery, and that's the third element, right? So you have the road to Moresco, the physical road going to Moresco. You have the road to Moresco, which is finding her mother.
Mm-hmm.
Or finding out about her mother kind of idea. And then the third one is about the self-discovery, about finding out more about her inner self. Because as she and I talked about her history, it was pretty clear that she was feeling one way about herself. But as we were talking more about her life. And I was, by virtue of some of the stuff that I had trained, you know, been reading about and learning from myself.
Yeah.
And I was bringing that to the table and talking to her with it about it. And she started to think about some of the stuff that has gone in, you know, wrong in her life, if you will, wrong in a, you know, very pejorative sense. And I think that towards the end, you get a sense that she no longer has the same level of rage.
Mm.
She no longer has the same level of weight. She described it as a weight on her chest. You know, she thought she had heart problems. She had so much weight on her chest. So being able to get her past that was really rewarding experience. And as a result of all of that, I was inspired by her story. I was touched and moved by the experience of knowing her.
Mm-hmm.
I had 18 pages of outline.
Wow. Has she read this book?
Unfortunately, she passed away before I could finish it.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
I was able to share it with her sons.
Okay.
And they love it. So that's, I was thankful for that. But
yeah,
it flowed out of me. Just, I couldn't not write it. You know what I mean? I didn't actually set about writing a book.
And this is your first book, isn't it?
Very first book.
That's what I thought.
Never thought of myself as being an author. This was just more of something like I had to get the story out. I had to get people to know the story. I actually was searching for a ghostwriter.
Oh, were you?
I had this, you know, I just sat down one day. It was 2021. It was towards the end of COVID. Things were quiet still. And I just started writing, tapping away on the computer, flow of consciousness, just letting my mind dump the story out. And I had 160 pages, roughly, maybe a little bit less. And I was like, you know, in the hands of somebody really capable, this could be something.
Hmm.
This could be something. Somebody could take this and they could really turn it into something. And God bless them. Somebody's got that talent out there.
And you didn't think at that point that someone could be you?
I did not.
Wow.
Did not.
When was the first time you realized, hey, maybe I could actually pull this off?
I'm still aghast at people saying, wow, this is really good. I'm like, are you sure you're not just saying that?
Well, that's really something. Have you been that way in your life about all kinds of other things too, or just about writing? Like, what about, you're the co-founder of this healthcare. Like, are you like thinking, geez, how did I pull that off? Like, how did I make that happen? Or are you just like, oh yeah, I did that thing?
I kind of don't believe that's happened either, but I don't know if it's a combination of two things. I would love to be able to say, Bruce, that my approach to it is strictly one of humbleness or whatever, but a lot of it comes from a low self-esteem. And I just never think of myself as being the person who could do that.
Yeah. What gave you that low self-esteem?
It's a good question. Variety of things. My childhood was one very focused on achievement. You know, if I came home with the 97, my parents were the type that said, well, why didn't you get the extra credit? So never quite good enough.
Who was more so that way, your dad or your mom?
Yes. It was a shared trait.
They were both like that. So that's a double whammy. It's not like one is saying, no, he's fine. He worked hard. He got a good mark. Yep. One didn't balance the other one out.
No.
They're both like 97. Like, what the heck? Why didn't you get a 99 or 100?
Right. Or 105. Wow. There was extra credit on this test. I see that you could have gotten 105.
Oh, wow. And so that you must have really, really been affected by that, because it's not just marks at school, right? It's like how you do anything, how you do everything. Am I right?
That's part of it. Yeah. And there are other elements, I think, that contributed to it. I don't like to make a big deal out of it. I am adopted. People suggest that children who are adopted also tend to have a bit of a challenge trying to establish that initial sense of self.
Sure.
Do you have siblings? There's this separation. It's implicit. Even, I mean, I wasn't lied to. My parents told me day one, and this is kind of the situation. We love you. The statement was always, we don't love you as if you are our son. You are our son, and we love you. Right. That was always the message. Very consistent. And I believe them truly. That's exactly how they felt. And I should accept that and be grateful for it. What I didn't fully comprehend, again, until this most recent time period where I started doing the work and started unraveling, unpacking things, was that as a four-year-old child or younger, we'll say four, six, you're starting to develop some cognitive capabilities and, you're starting to be more aware of things and you're starting to have some real feelings as opposed to reactive. There's always a question in my head as a child, well, where did I really come from?
Sure.
And I remember, going to family reunions and they'd say, hey, mom, who's that good looking girl? And I was like, that's your cousin. And it's like, well, I'm not part of the family. Right? So there's this mental separation, but a physical connection, but a mental separation, emotional separation. So where do you belong?
Yeah.
And I think that contributes to it as well. And then the third part of it is I'm a super sensitive person. Some people, again, lots of studies on this, whatever, they say, the more intelligent you are, the more sensitive you are. Whatever. I mean, I'm not trying to put any labels on it. I'm not trying to explain it away or anything. I did well in school. My parents wanted to encourage me to continue doing well in school. I was pushed to constantly striving. Again, let's go back, depression era children, raising a child, get a job, do well, establish yourself, right? Move forward.
Yeah.
So this was the roadmap. These were the things that were pushed on me. And I felt like I had to measure up to do that. And as a result, you're never quite done. There's always more to be done, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So the startup, worked over, again, 3 decades plus in the industry. I've seen a lot of problems. I've seen a lot of issues. I had the opportunity to get together with my other co-founders to try to create something that addresses a lot of the challenges that we see in the healthcare space.
Yeah.
We think we're doing something meaningful. It's the passion that gets me out of bed in the morning. It makes me want to dive in, and that could be a whole other podcast because,
Are you making a difference with this startup you did, with this healthcare thing? Well, I don't know anything about it.
Yeah. Every Health is the startup. We're a new health insurance company, plain and simple. Like, I think Aetna, United, Blue Cross Blue Shield, they're our competition.
Okay. And you're in the United States, so people need that. Right?
Yeah. In a way, we're redefining things. It has more to do with rethinking the business model as something that, as you as a consumer, you should be able to experience your health insurance like you do as a consumer on Amazon or as a consumer on, the Apple Store site or as a consumer at Saks Fifth Avenue or whatever, right? Whatever your retail outlet is of choice. It's the same idea. It's a consumer-based business. But instead of just paying lip service to the idea of a consumer-based business, we've redesigned the entire customer experience using today's technology. We've redesigned the entire customer experience with regard to how the benefit plan works. We're working directly with our physicians, so we have relationships with the physicians in the market that we serve. We're working with our physicians as our business partners.
Okay.
How many times do you open the newspaper up and you say, like, well, this insurance company is going to war against this hospital system. Again, they're at loggerheads, and you know, this, they may be dropped out of the network because they can't come to terms on the contract, or they start pointing fingers at each other. And well, that's not a business relationship. Those aren't partners.
Right. No,
no. Yeah.
It's not a good thing for sure.
It's an us versus them situation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not going to build a collaborative work environment that's going to benefit the consumer. Because at the end of the day, the consumer is going to go see a physician in that health system, and that health, that doctor is going to say, well, you know, your health insurance company sucks. Here's why. Now, the consumer's put into an awkward position.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Now, they got to listen to this doctor vent about how bad they're, I mean, they don't want to support, they don't want to be the, you know, cheerleader for the insurance company. They're not going to want to have to be. So why put them in that position at all in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we strive to have a better relationship with our physicians as business partners, and build that collective 360 type of environment around the consumer. And that's how we differentiate ourselves.
Interesting. And are you the CEO of the company?
Oh, no. I am the CFO and chief actuary. Remember, I told you, I'm the numbers guy. I'm all
right. You never stop thinking about this stuff, do you?
I don't. This
I can tell that.
This is I can go on. Like I said, this is a whole other podcast. I could this is something I'm very passionate about. I spent a lot of time thinking about this stuff, and my other co-founders serve. One's the CEO, and one's the chief operating officer. We have worked side by side, living in the same condo out in California during our startup phase. And we were just back in 2018. And, you know, every day we're talking and trying to figure out how we can continuously improve. We're never done improving. Every day is an opportunity to do something better. And that's how we, that's a culture we try to create in our company as well. So we're growing, and we're expanding, and we're having an impact, and our members love us, and the physicians love working with us, and everything seems to be working. So it's exciting to see it kind of come to fruition.
And are you also working on a second book?
Yeah, you are, aren't you?
Well, you don't have to tell us about your second book, but I'm pretty excited to read this book. It's one of the few that I haven't read. When I interview my guests, I've almost always read the books. This one I haven't read, and I'm really interested in it because, wow, like you've already told us so many reasons to be interested in it. But tell me about the feedback you've received from your readers.
Yeah, you know, I had... There are several different ways you can get reviews. One of them is there's a platform called Goodreads.
Yes.
And they run promos, right? So I gave copies of the book away for free.
Right.
And you hope that they read the book and give you a review. So that's that's one way to get reviews. Yeah. There are several platforms out there. Some of them do it juried. You know, you submit it and they'll read like the first 15 pages, and if it's captivating enough and they want to read more, then they'll review the whole book. There are others you pay, and they'll assign somebody to read the book and give you a review. I'll tell you what, I did not appreciate how difficult it was to have this be found. I'm not even trying to go for like New York Times bestseller list stuff, right? I'm an independent first-time author. I'm nobody on the scene. I don't know anybody in this industry. I don't have the right contacts, the right network. I'm zero, right? I'm at nothing. But I'm so passionate and inspired by the story. I want people to read it just because of that.
I can tell. I can tell how passionate you are. Yeah.
And I had... And I have to be honest here, too, that I kind of feel like I've done enough, because I had one person who was a reviewer on one of those juried things.
Yeah.
And is the onlinebookclub.org.
Yes. Right.
And the reviewer sent me a note on the side, personal note, and said, reading the book changed her life.
Oh, wow.
And I just thought to myself, you know what? drop mic. That's it. I mean, I wrote the book so that people could read this and be as inspired and be touched and to read some of the things. And I was, yes, there's history in the book. I tried to intertwine as much of these people's personal lives with the actual events that were happening during that time period. So the context of war in Europe and political situations and social upheaval in the 1960s, 1970s United States could be felt as being important to the development of the character, their lives, why they made decisions the way they made them, what direction they decided to go in with their lives, that type of stuff. This is context. Some people have said too much history. Another debate for another day.
Well, you're going to get a lot of different people's ideas,
exactly.
Right?
Can't please everybody.
No.
I infused a lot of philosophy and psychology into the book too, because again, you have to get into their heads. Why? What kind of conversations are they having? What kind of situations are they facing? How are they feeling? In today's market, there's a big push for authors to show, don't tell.
Mm-hmm.
Don't say Maria Luisa was sad.
Right.
Show us that she's sad. Well, okay. Right. Well, how do you want me to show you that? Right? So Maria Luisa sits on the corner of her kitchen table sobbing. I didn't tell you she's sad, but I explained.
Right.
So now you're involved. The feedback I've gotten has been truly humbling and exceptional and very surprising.
Mm.
Vivid, compelling. I feel like they're my family.
Wow, do you? That's really cool, because you already said that you were looking for your family. Like you were, when you were a kid, you were like, geez, I wonder where I came from. What was my family? And now you're saying to me, this is my family.
Well, these reviewers are saying as they read this book, they read this book and they say like, they're walking the same streets as the Morescos. They feel right. Like the Morescos were their next door neighbors or their family. They're that involved. So I told the story in such a way that it drew them in, that they were so heavily invested in these characters.
Yeah.
That it was just captivating.
You've created family for people.
Yes.
This is really cool.
Yeah. And that's very touching.
Yeah, I guess. That is fantastic.
So we talked about being connected.
There you go. Connection is so important for you. And you've written this book as part of it, and you didn't even set out to write the book.
I didn't. Like I said, in fact, it was after I talked to the third person. Again, I was looking for a ghostwriter. The first one said, I could write this for you, but I think you should write it yourself. The second person said, I could write this for you, but you should write it yourself. The third person said, I'd love to be part of this, but you should write this yourself.
Oh, I thought that's where you were going.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And then did those three people all finally convince you? Is that when you decided?
You know, I still was very doubtful. I was like, I'm going to guess you're too busy doing your own thing.
Right.
You
don't there must be some other reason.
Well, something other. Yeah. Something
yeah,
other.
You just don't want to do it, or you're just making an excuse.
Right. Exactly. It's like you're being nice.
Yeah.
In fact, I told him, I said, listen, if it's only going to be something that I should just print out a couple of copies and like give to family and friends as Christmas presents, then tell me.
Well, and the funny thing is, I interview authors all the time, and I don't think people are all that kind all the time. When people write books, they're, publishers, whoever, they're like, oh, this is garbage, forget it, give it up. Like, people are cruel about this usually. Am I right?
I usually. And so I'll tell you the scariest day of my life when I pressed on the Kindle Direct Publishing.
Yeah.
The little green button that says publish.
Yeah.
And my finger was hovering over the button, and I was like, what the hell am I about to do?
Wow. That was the scariest day of your life.
So scary. So vulnerable. So vulnerable.
That's wild. Yeah, yeah, it is, isn't it?
Like, okay, here's my child. Please accept it.
Because you've written all that stuff. Yeah, I created this. This is my thing.
Yeah, and you never know how it's going to be accepted.
This is from my heart. This is from every fiber of my being. And it's all about connection and so much more.
And it's an interesting thing. What you just said is spot on. I couldn't have said it better myself. Because I'm not trained as a writer, I can't divorce myself from my characters.
Yeah.
I don't have that creative tool set of years and years of schooling and training and whatnot. As a result, when I'm writing about, let's say, for example, Marcello. Mm-hmm. Marcello is a character you meet very early in the story. He's playing in the street in Taurima, a small town in Sicily. It has just rained. The water is running down the street in the curb. And he's playing with sticks in the water as it's running down the curb. It's boats. He's floating down the river and he's playing his little pirates game. And well, that's me. That's me when I was six. And my father was watering the lawn. And the lawn was so dry, the water was running right off of the lawn into the street. So I was playing in the street with little popsicle sticks, floating them on the water. And damming the water up before it went down into the grate, and so that I had a pond and I was having my little naval battles going.
That's
with my
so
pirate ships.
Amazing. And where did you grow up?
In a small town in Connecticut called Avon.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this book just is filled with you, your thoughts, your being, your life, your stories. And yet it's about this person. I always ask my guests about if they have a story about bullying. Do you have a quick story at all about that topic?
You know, I think everybody goes through some phase of being bullied in their life. I'm no exception to that rule, right? Sure, I've had bullies and I've experienced bullying in my life. I'm sure there are people out there who said in one way, shape, or form or another, I probably bullied them too. I know that at the end of the day, though, in that moment, there's very little that can be done. You know, the protagonist is going to do what they're going to do.
Yeah.
They're going to be the bully.
Yeah.
They have a variety of life situations and emotions and circumstances that are way beyond anybody's control and ability to dissuade them at that moment in time.
Mm-hmm.
We can look as a society to try to remove and minimize the preponderance of those circumstances and situations, to try to remove the sense, the idea of the necessity of bullying, the need to act out and to vent those circumstances and frustrations and feelings and whatnot. I don't know that that's even possible. Even if you remove one layer, there's another layer, right? Mm-hmm. It's like being on a soccer team when you go running around the fields in a single line, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's always somebody who's slowest. If you cut the person who's slowest, the next person is slowest.
Yeah, that's right.
There's always going to be, right? So there's always, same idea, there's always going to be some sort of minimal type of criteria in society that's going to impact people negatively because it is in some way, shape, or form viewed as being less than the next level up.
Yeah.
It would be wonderful to get to a society where less than wasn't in our vocabulary.
Sure.
But that I don't see how that will ever happen. Because that's happened since the beginning of mankind. As soon as there was three, one looked at the other and said, wait a second, why am I not being included here?
Yeah.
Why am I less than?
Yeah.
Right? So it's been a situation that, as a result, I think the best we can do in these circumstances is, you talk about mindfulness at the top of our discussion. We talked about a lot of things with regard to letting go. We find compassion within ourselves to understand and forgive ourselves for what we may have done in the past. And I think along the same lines, that same level of mindfulness, peacefulness that we can achieve for ourselves extends to the compassion that we have to feel for other people.
Yeah.
The letting go of whatever that was, it happened.
Yeah, well stated.
It was unfortunate. It doesn't mean it was right, but it's one of these things that we always have to strive. I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying it's necessarily justified. What I'm saying is it's an effort. Mm-hmm. It's an effort on both parts to find the compassion to let go of that scar that binds you both in the past.
Yeah. Very profound. Yes. Well, as we move forward in the interview, I want to ask you five quick answer questions, and you really have to give me 30-second answers. Who is one person that has been a powerful influence in your life?
I guess I'll call my mother, who, despite her methods, was always there to push me and to encourage me and mm-hmm. to let me know that no matter what, I always had a home.
How has mindfulness affected how you deal with your emotions?
I'm a lot calmer. I'm a lot more purposeful in how I talk. I'm a lot more aware of an emotion that will creep in. And I have the ability now to recognize it, to understand where that emotion is coming from within me for whatever's happening, and to allow that emotion basically to pass through me, if you will. You know, I don't hold on to things like I used to.
Well, what about breathing? Is there a thing you have to say about breathing?
Again, going back to the yoga, there are a lot of breathing techniques that people will use to calm themselves down in the moment of crisis or extreme anxiety or anger. You know, count down by count, do the alphabet in reverse,
yeah.
Or, you know, count to 10, hold your breath, whatever. All right. So those are one type of breathing exercise.
Mm-hmm.
But going back to my yoga practice, I have a breath work sequence. It's called, there's a variety of them. My favorite happens to be what they call a Kalabhati, mm-hmm. or a breath of fire kind of thing. It's where you breathe out through your nose rapidly several times. And those breathing exercises in yoga, it isn't meant to create this peaceful mindfulness kind of thing, but rather it's meant to awaken this energy inside you,
right,
to basically create this mindset that you're capable of doing fill in the blank.
Your book, The Road to Maresco. Wow.
Yeah.
It just sounds amazing. Are there any other books? Is there a single book you would recommend that is somehow related to mindfulness?
Are you familiar with The Journey to Ixtlan?
Yeah.
That would be the book I'd point people to.
Ah, okay. Any apps you're going to recommend?
I am more of a find it on YouTube kind of person. I don't know if YouTube counts as an app.
Well, some people think it does. YouTube is, kind of an app. It's been a very interesting conversation. What words of advice do you have for our listeners?
Be kind to yourself.
Mm.
You are in a unique position. You're not relative to anybody else. Just recognize and accept yourself as the first step. And if you can do that, if you can really do that, you will literally start to cry, because you'll never have felt that amount of love for yourself ever before. And it will shock you to your core.
What a great message to end on. Yeah. Wow. Thank you for that. What website would we go to learn more about you?
The website I have set up for the book is on the web at mark-jamilkowski-author.com.
JAMILKOWSKI. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And it's also on Amazon.
Sure.
So, I mean, it's all these things linked together. I've got a Twitter account, Road to Maresco.
It's been cool talking to you. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much. And you have a great rest of your day, Mark.
You too, Bruce. It's been a pleasure chatting with you.
Yeah, for sure. Bye now.
Bye now.
Mindful Tribe, thanks for being here. Thanks for listening. And take what we've learned today to reach new heights of calm, focus, and happiness. Stay in the mode.